My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Sean Levy. Sean, welcome back to KBOO.
Oh, thanks, Ed.
Let me tell you about Sean Levy, as if you don't know. He's been writing for the Oregonian since 92 and serving as the major film critic there since 97. Is that correct? Yeah. Before that, you were senior editor of American Film Magazine, which I still miss. And prior to that, the associate editor of Box Office Magazine. You've also written about film, pop culture, books, and sports. You're a soccer writer. For the New York Times, the LA Times, the Guardian of London, the San Francisco Chronicle, blah, blah, blah. There's a lot of them.
All going out of business.
Hey, welcome to the modern world. You're the author of four books, The Last Playboy, The High Life of Porfirio Rubirosa, Ready, Steady, Go, The Smashing Rise and Giddy Fall of Swinging London, Rat Pack Confidential, and The King of Comedy, The Life and Art of Jerry Lewis. I've interviewed you for all those except the Porfirio Rubirosa book.
It seems to me that's true, yeah.
Yeah. And now we have Paul Newman Alive. Paul Newman Alive is published by Harmony Books. Sean Levy, S-H-A-W-N Levy, L-E-V-Y.
SeanLevy.com.
SeanLevy.com, if you want to get a hold of him and express your admiration for his movie reviews. Well, listen, you know, here's the thing. I talk to people a lot, and everybody says, oh, you know, that's Sean Levy. I said, hey, wait a minute. Two things about Sean Levy you have to know. First of all, he knows movies. And second of all, everything he writes, he has thought about and is worth reading.
Gracious. Thank you.
No, that's really true. I mean, one of the things, we've been friends now for what? 10 years?
More than that. If we talked about Jerry Lewis.
Yeah, right. I've always been impressed with not only your education, but also your ability to use that education in a creative way. So.
Well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Why biographies? Why, you're more or less a journalist. I guess you have to call yourself a journalist.
Certainly, I'm using the tools of journalism in these books. And of course, if I write features, news stories for the paper or blog about news, I use the techniques and standards of newspaper journalism, yeah.
Mm-hmm. The thing about biography is that it's a very highly specialized form of journalism or history in a way.
Mm-hmm.
And what attracted you to that form?
You know, I'm not sure. I have a background in academia. I have an MFA in creative writing. I have a degree in poetry, but I also have a master's in English, and that was about Renaissance English and Italian lyric poetry.
Well, you can tell us about Petrarch and sonnets.
Exactly. In fact, that was my subspecialty. And, you know, there's detective work in that, and that always appealed to me, the amassing of an argument and then telling a story to make the argument. And, in fact, you mentioned the demise of American Film Magazine. When that magazine went out of business, among the things I thought of as a way to support my family was writing books, and I knew that if you picked a person whose life had enough incidents in it, you could fill up the pages of a book. It would take a long time. It'd be like digging a big trench, but you could do it. Whereas I didn't know for sure I could come up with an entire novel. Because the chronology and incidents of a life and the artifacts of a life are pre-existing, you know that you have, you know, in the case of Paul Newman, 83 years, 60-odd movies, a racing career, a food career, a philanthropic career, a political life, a marriage, children, etc., etc. You know, you write enough about each of those things, and soon enough you fill up the page between the hardbacks.
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things about people like Paul Newman or Jerry Lewis or the Sinatra gang was that they led a very public life, and there's lots of stuff about them. Some of it is even true.
Quite a bit. You know, it's funny that, you know, other reporters' work tends to stand up more often than not. So take that, Ms. Palin.
Yes, but she's an idiot, so you need to.
Well, you know, that never was a liability to anyone in this country anyhow.
Yeah. Having discovered why biography attracted you, the first one was Jerry Lewis. And I know that we used to talk about Jerry Lewis a lot, and you've always been a great fan of Jerry Lewis and admired him for his skill as a director and his innovations in creating film. I always admired him as a comic, and sometimes I even liked his movies. I mean, I liked quite a lot of them. But then you had to pick your subjects, let's say, after that. That might have been the first guy that popped into your head. Why Paul Newman?
Well, Newman, in fact, around the time I was thinking about Jerry Lewis, in my head I made a short list, and this was about 1993, and in that short list was Paul Newman. And in that short list were other people who I still don't think anyone's written a good book about that could be written about. And you need to find someone who has this complete story that I'm saying, you know, that will fill a book to describe their life. And you need to find a hole in the market. You know, you don't come out and write a biography of James Joyce the year after Richard Ellman's James Joyce wins, you know, every known prize.
By
yeah.
the way.
One of the greatest books I've ever read.
Yes.
You know, you'd be an idiot, and no one would pay you to be an idiot. I was trying to support a
Governor
family.
Governor of Alaska. Okay, I'm sorry.
And you could expense your idiocy too, which is amazing. I looked for holes. Looked for holes in the record. Jerry Lewis. No one had written a proper full-length biography of Jerry Lewis prior to my book. My book appeared in 96. The previous book that was even half about Jerry Lewis was in 73. And there had been much of his life since then, 20-odd years. Plus, the first guy didn't do a great job or B, a full job. Ditto the Rat Pack. There hadn't been a book about... There'd been books about Sinatra. There'd been books about Dean Martin and Sammy Davis Jr., Peter Lawford. But no one had taken those years and that phenomenon and put it together since, like, 1962. And I was writing in 97, 98. Ditto Swinging London. Ditto Porfirio Rubirosa. And finally, Paul Newman. Now I was looking for a subject. It was 2005. So it was 12 or 13 years after I had first considered Newman. And at that time, there was a pretty good but not great book about Paul Newman and Joanne Woodward that was only 3 years old. Again, you know, if that book hadn't sold and the fact that it existed, no publisher was going to take a chance on a book like that. And it was a dead subject for me. When in 2005 I looked, that book existed. And then there were two books that came out in 96. One was very good, but it was essentially a coffee table book. And it wasn't very complete. It was only about 15,000-20,000 words of text, although good. And the other was a really scurrilous book that, you know, was published by a small press and by a guy whose work is often sloppy. And, you know, he quotes dead people saying libelous things about dead people, type of author. So there was a hole where Paul Newman's name was on the bookshelf. You know, I realized that someone could do a full-length biography and tell a great story, a great American story, a story filled with the glamour of Hollywood and some great movies, race car driving, philanthropy, the food business, a real character who comes from unlikely origins. It was screaming to be written. Mm-hmm. And I started, as I say, in 2005. Paul Newman died in September of 2008 while I was nearing the end of my writing. I had been researching for nearly 3 years, and the book finally, you know, the last edits and stuff were done very, you know, it was published in May. Boy, I think in February or March, I still had the opportunity to put out, you know, Screaming Fires and things like that. Even still, there's a howling error on one page of this book.
You want to tell us what it is?
No! You're so clever. One guy wrote me and found it out. None of the reviewers saw it. So, you know, people will find it. And it's only in the first edition. So if you've got the howling error that you can't recognize, congratulations. You've got a rare one.
Mm-hmm. When Newman came along, into the film business, and I'll let you speak a little bit of how he actually got into the film business. I was a huge fan of Marlon Brando. In fact, I would have to say I worship Marlon Brando. I saw The Wild One when I was maybe 10 years old. I think it came out in 53.
Actually, I think it's older than that.
Is it older?
51.
51? Yeah, well, so yeah. I was even younger. Yeah, 8, 9, 10, 11, whatever, yeah. 8, 9, 10 years old. And I was, I had a boy crush on Marlon Brando. And then shortly thereafter, I saw Desiree, which is a thoroughly crappy movie in every way, but Brando played Napoleon.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I loved him for that, too, you know? And then I saw him as Mark Antony
in
Julius
quite
Caesar.
And Joe Mankiewicz's Julius Caesar. I think he's quite good in that film.
He is. And I was totally smitten by this guy. So anyway, Brando is the bull goose in this.
And you didn't mention his two best films from that time, On the Waterfront Streetcar Named Desire.
Streetcar Named Desire.
Viva Zapata is in that period
as
well.
Oh, yes. Viva Zapata is another movie.
His first six or seven films.
I saw all of those
just,
movies.
Just, you know, the outfielder didn't even turn around to watch the ball leave the park. That's how hard he hit them.
That's right. And he set a standard for a modern film acting, which in many ways has never been equaled.
He invented it. He invented a type of screen acting that, you know, you can see precursors to Brando. If you look around, there are people.
John Garfield.
Yeah, but not even so much that there's an actual line connecting them through their teachers and the people who they studied with and their actual intent. But you can see actors who are doing things like Brando, who had no idea, had never heard of Stella Adler or Lee Strasberg. Mm-hmm. Someone like Conrad Veidt in his German films. Peter Lorre, for that matter.
Yeah.
He's doing something very close to method acting in M.
But isn't anybody that came out of that UFA gang in Germany between the wars were working with directors whose personal styles are not that different from Stanislavski. Is that making too much of a leap?
Yeah, I think it might be. I think you know, particularly both.
It's European as opposed to.
Yeah, they had a theory. So maybe that's it. It was theory-based acting, mm-hmm. But it wasn't Stanislavski, and it wasn't the American method, which mm-hmm. Brando, you know, invented and embodied. In fact, there's the question then becomes, well, Newman comes up in the wake of Brando. He's been to the Actors Studio. In his first couple of films, he's accused of being sort of like a dime store Brando.
Terrible charge, by the way. Not
yeah,
true.
It's not true. I mean, you know, there is. Anyone who plays a palooka after Terry Molloy in On the Waterfront is riffing off Marlon Brando. It's inevitable. Rocky, Raging Bull, Somebody Up There Likes Me, Newman's breakthrough film. But, you know, lots of trumpeters took from Louis Armstrong. That doesn't make them bad trumpeters.
No, yeah.
You know, lots of people had the idea after Picasso had it first. That doesn't make them bad painters.
Young guys always need an influence to work off of.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it's funny that Newman had to carry around this fake Brando charge. De Niro has two Oscars, one for Raging Bull, one for Godfather Part II. And one he was, in both of them, he's playing Brando. In fact, he's got Brando's speeches in both films. He has the Terry Molloy in the back of the car speech in Raging Bull, and he says, "I'll make him an offer he can't refuse" in the Godfather Part II. Mm-hmm. Hello, if anyone was the new Brando, it was De Niro. But, of course, that was decades later, and Newman had the charge around his neck.
Mm-hmm. Where did Newman come out of? He's an Ohio boy. How the hell did he wind up as an actor?
Boy, it's a crazy story, and one of the things I like best about him, he's kind of like a Tom Sawyer figure. He comes from a well-to-do background. His father was a Jewish sporting goods retailer in Cleveland, and the family owned a home in Shaker Heights, which was and is a very beautiful
Cleveland suburb.
It's a suburb. It's done on the English Garden model, and it was a planned community in the 1920s built on a rapid transit line. And somehow Art Newman managed to hold, the dad managed to hold on to that house and that lifestyle during the Depression. Paul was born in 1925, and a store that sold hockey sticks and radios and microscopes and you know, fishing gear and stuff like that in a downtown big location managed to survive the worst economic crisis of the century, which is a credit, I think, to the old man. And the boys, Paul and his brother, went to college. By the time Newman was college age, the war was on. So he went one term to Ohio University in Athens. Then he spent about 3 years in the Navy, about a year and a half on active duty in the Pacific. Sort of he wasn't on the front lines, but he was close to some action. He was he trained airmen and supplied torpedo bombers, and he flew as a rear gunner on a torpedo bomber in the Pacific. He never saw any action. He survived a kamikaze attack when a squadron that he was assigned to failed to launch because someone had an earache, and they were meant to be on the Bunker Hill, which suffered the worst kamikaze attack of the war, mm-hmm. and Newman's squadron would have been housed in an area that was wiped out. And then he came back and he went to Kenyon College for 3 years, and through a series of misadventures, he wound up acting. And he had acted in high school and he had acted in grade school in school plays, but never in any sort of distinguished capacity. But at Kenyon, he really had a spark and he liked it. And he had a plan to become a professional actor or become an acting teacher, get a drama degree. Teach English and drama at a university. He liked that. He liked the fraternity atmosphere. He went off to Summerstock. He got married. Then his father died. He and his wife and his baby had to come back to Cleveland. He worked in the sporting goods store for a year. Then he went to Yale School of Drama. He had actually
big deal.
Yeah, yeah. Although, you know, apparently you could do it. He didn't have a distinguished academic record at Kenyon. I never did see his Yale papers. I saw his Kenyon papers.
Let me interrupt you for a second.
Sure.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm talking with Paul Newman. I'm talking with Sean Levy. The title of his book is Paul Newman, A Life, and it's published by Harmony.
A lot of people mistake us.
Yeah,
well, on TV especially. I get it all the time.
Yeah, I know. Well, it's a drag, isn't it?
So yeah, we have this guy, he's at Yale, and he gets discovered by a New York agent. You know, you got to remember, this is New York, 1952. Live television is thriving. The theater is still in high gear, and you have great playwrights, Arthur Miller, Tennessee Williams, William Inge, writing. Movies had broken away from the Hollywood backlot, and more movies were being shot on location in New York City in that time by the studios than ever before. So it was a great place to be an actor. There was television, there was commercials, there was all this stuff. And one summer, instead of staying in New Haven and selling encyclopedias, he decided to move to Staten Island with his wife and baby, sell encyclopedias, and go in to see if he could get acting jobs. And he got hired for virtually every acting job he was up for, and he never went back to school.
Mm-hmm. When I was looking for some information on you online, just to find something for the bio that I read at the beginning, there are a lot of websites out there that are angry with you.
Oh, ish.
Well, no, I understand you don't care.
There's a handful.
But I want to talk about this just for a second, because what they're saying, in effect, is that you have desecrated the corpse of Paul Newman.
In fact, that was going to be the subtitle of the book, but
the desecrated corpse?
Yeah, that change didn't go through.
Yeah. First of all,
also,
you started
Paul, another name that we thought of was Paul Newman. Too soon?
Too soon, yeah. First of all, you started the book way before Paul Newman died.
Yeah.
That's number one.
But now, he was an old man, but that was, he lived a full life. That's why you pick someone. You don't write a book about Leo DiCaprio, because he only got 28, 30 years to write about.
He wasn't killed in an auto wreck either, which is kind of astonishing. But the thing I want to ask about is the reason these people are so exercised is that you've written about Paul Newman, as they say, the cliche is warts and all. That even though he was a wonderful man, even though he was very funny, even though he was politically correct, even though he was a philanthropist of the first magnitude, the guy had flaws, and you're supposed to give us those flaws. Isn't that what a biographer does?
Yeah, it's not publicity for Paul Newman.
Yeah.
Nobody who's read this book feels that the preponderance of the book is remotely negative. I mean, there are, you say warts and all. I almost think it's like wart and all. He liked to drink beer.
Quite a lot of it.
Woof, woof. Boy, I mean, right there, you can just see him on a spit in hell, can't you?
When I first heard that he drank a case of beer a day, I said, BS, nobody drinks a case of beer a day.
So many people would testify to that in court. It's just a given. It's just a given. How he was so fit, Newman's luck, and he did hundreds of crunches and rode a bike and took saunas just about every day.
Mm-hmm.
He was a fit guy. He knew that his body was his livelihood. Secondly, he, in the 50 years in which he was married to his second wife, Joanne Woodward, for whom he left a wife of 9 years and three children, in those 50 years, I came across evidence that at least one time another woman had carnal knowledge of him. And I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
It's not your fault, Sean.
It doesn't make him a bad man or a bad husband. I draw no conclusion from it other than the fact that the Newmans managed to absorb and move past that incident and stay married for another 40 years. And I interviewed the woman who was involved with him, and I have documentary evidence that satisfies me and a libel lawyer at Random House, because remember, Newman was alive when I was discovering this stuff, and he could sue if it wasn't true. He can't now, but the woman in question can. I told her, I'm not interested in you and what happened between you and him. I'm interested in the fact that you came and went and they stayed together.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think that the achievement of a 50-year marriage, even on the heels of a divorce, is astonishing, particularly given the fact that they were both in show business, particularly given his status as a sex symbol for decades. So the people who got upset about this were reacting to a Page Six report that came out about 6 weeks before the book was published, that the book paints him as a philanderer and a drunk. Well, what I say is, how many women does it take to philander? Because I only found the one. And two, not a drunk, but drunk. Mm-hmm. And I have no evidence of him being drunk on a set or drunk at a meeting or drunk in a race car or doing any of the activities he did all the time. I have evidence of him drinking a lot of Coors and Budweiser, which frankly, you could drink three times that you can of a good local microbrew and not feel the effects, particularly if you were drinking it every day.
Of course, it's good for putting out fires.
Yeah. You know, so I mean, anyone who got upset about that, A, didn't read the book, and B, wasn't issued a life when they were issuing lives, and they need to get one.
Isn't part of the problem that when people are fans of whoever it is, whether it's a writer or a ball player or an actor,
politician,
that they don't want to see anything but the good stuff, and what they were really looking for is a puff piece, and no responsible journalist will write a puff piece.
Yeah, I mean, I had a contract with Harmony Books to write the biography of the guy, not to write an ad for him.
Exactly.
You know,
yeah.
So I wasn't trolling for these things. I didn't go, you know, the James Carville line about Paula Jones. I didn't drag a $100 bill on a fishing line through a trailer park.
Right.
I found written evidence of this woman, and it triangulated with other things I knew that couldn't have been known otherwise. And then I found the woman and interviewed her and spoke to someone else. And then I didn't keep going. I heard all sorts of appalling things. The thing is, what could I publish and what did I want to spend my time pursuing?
Mm-hmm.
What I could publish would be anything that wouldn't be libelous, because again, he wasn't dead until I was almost done with the writing. B, what I would want to do, I didn't write this book to desecrate the corpse of Paul Newman, for God's sake. This is the fifth book I've written. It's the first guy who has been a central character of my book that I, you know, would out and out admire and like leave with my daughter one night while I went out to dinner with my wife, you know.
She would love that.
She might, you know. It's one of the curious things I found out about him. He had six kids. He didn't become a grandpa until he was 70. That's pretty advanced for a guy with five daughters. You figure one of those girls would have been married young and had kids. And I think it's because no man could live up to the example of Paul Newman, whether in his own head or in the daughter's eyes.
Mm-hmm.
And I see him in that light. I think he was an extraordinary character. His achievements on the race car track would have been noteworthy on their own. His achievements as a food entrepreneur are singular. His philanthropy was phenomenal. There was a sub part of his philanthropy that was phenomenal. He was a delegate to the 1968 Chicago Convention. He wrote editorials for the Nation.
A lot of stuff happened there.
Yeah. He was an amazing character.
Chapter 23, the reason I have it marked is that this is what I would call a critical biography, in the sense that not only writing about the guy's life, but you're also evaluating his work at different stages in his life. And I would say that this chapter 23, if you buy the book for nothing but this, it's worth it, because it's one of the best pieces of film writing about an actor's career I've ever read. So take that.
Gosh, thank you. I called this a meta chapter.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the chronology of a guy's life moves like a clothesline. It starts on one wall, it ends at the other, and one damn thing after another, and you reach the other wall. This thing is hanging off that clothesline. It is not chronological. And there's another chapter like it in the front.
Yep.
There's one about Newman the man, and there's one about Newman the actor. And I stole these ideas from Richard Ellman, who in his James Joyce book stops for each of Joyce's major publications and does a critical chapter on Dubliners and Portrait of the Artist as a Young Man, Ulysses, Finnegan's Wake. And he, you know, you could read those as critical essays, or you can read them in place. And clearly they're connected, you know, sort of like by nerves and blood vessels to the book around them, but they are not of it. You know, you could remove them.
Let me ask a question. A mutual friend of ours, D.K. Holm, also works with me on KABU here, did an oral spoken review of your book. And one of the things he said is that for him, unlike, say, Brando with On the Waterfront, there was never the iconic Paul Newman film. Can you talk about that?
You know, I think that you could say, first of all, he had a much more period of time in his career that is productive is longer than Brando's, and he changes as an actor over time. So there are iconic roles, I think, at different moments.
Well, HUD,
The Hustler,
and
HUD,
the Hustler, yeah.
The Cool Hand Luke is an iconic film. Butch Cassidy and the Sundance Kid and the Sting, although because of the balance with Redford, they're iconic in their own way. I think Slapshot's a pretty dang iconic film.
You know, I've never seen that movie.
You've got to watch Slapshot tonight. You're going to laugh your head off. You're going to be, it's the best film George Roy Hill ever made. Mm-hmm. And I think it's my favorite Newman film. I truly do. But I think his best film is The Verdict. And
great movie.
Another iconic film later on is Nobody's Fool.
Oh,
now,
yes.
At his peak, is he ever as high as Brando? At his peak, no. But that just makes him like everyone else who ever lived.
Right.
And Brando had maybe four peaks. Maybe, you know, On the Waterfront and Streetcar Named Desire and The Godfather and Last Tango. And those covered 25 years. But in Newman's case, we're talking from the first film where he's even remotely iconic, depending on which one you prefer, Long Hot Summer or Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, all the way through Road to Perdition, that's almost 50 years.
Can you give us a minute on The Silver Chalice?
The Silver Chalice is a dreadful movie. It's the picture he got hired to make when Warner Brothers bought up his contract. He was appearing on Broadway in Picnic as the nice boy who got his sweetie taken away from him by the bad boy. And he got a standard studio contract. He's one of the last guys who became a major star who got the standard studio contract. And they put him in a sword and sandal picture shot by a director named Victor Seville on a back lot in Burbank. But in this expressionistic version of ancient Rome and Phoenicia and Judea, and filled with stilted dialogue, and Newman plays a slave who carves the images of the people who were in attendance at the Last Supper and actually sat Jesus down for a sitting to carve him. He walks into a glowing tent.
A
little to the left. You know, it's a completely ridiculous film, and Newman rightly knew that he was going to get flayed by the critics. And as he was making it, he called New York and said to his agents, you got to get me into another play. You got to get me into another play, because he couldn't make another movie unless he made it for Warner Brothers, but he could work on Broadway. And they got him through a lucky break. They got him a part in The Desperate Hours, which is the great drama about the escaped prisoners who hold a suburban family hostage while they're waiting for a getaway car. And it's very unique. Newman played it on Broadway in a production with Carl Malden as the dad of the family and directed by Robert Montgomery, the actor.
The actor.
At the same time, they were making the film in Hollywood with Humphrey Bogart as the gunman instead of Paul Newman, Frederick March as the father of the family, and William Wyler as the director. The same guy wrote the stage play and the movie, and they came out about a year and a half apart. And the play was a big hit, but it would have been a bigger hit except for the fact that the movie was coming out, so the play had to end its run. But it rescued his career. Mm-hmm. And then also James Dean died. And they were going to act together in a Hemingway story on television about a pug boxer and Nick Adams, the young man who meets him and learns his story. And Newman was going to play the young man, and Dean was going to start the episode in old man makeup. And as he told his story, they would take makeup off him until at the end of the story, he was going to be a young man. Dean was killed. Newman switched roles. He played the boxer. And on the strength of that, he got hired to be in Somebody Up There Likes Me to play Rocky Graziano.
Right,
and that was his breakthrough film. And Portland people are going to love this. The guy who wrote Somebody Up There Likes Me, Roland Barber, is a journalist. He lives in Southwest Portland. His son Dave Barber is the owner-operator of Three Square Grill and Piccolopolis.
Yes.
And Dave's a friend, and Roland's a friend, and he's a very dear man. He wrote Jack Dempsey's autobiography. He wrote Harpo Speaks. He wrote The Night They Raided Minsky's.
Yes.
And he was a mentor to generations of journalists as a teacher at USC.
We really only have 30 seconds here. I know you don't like to talk about your next project, but how far along are you on the next project? Are you rolling with it?
I've zeroed in on a couple of ideas for any number of reasons, you know, college tuition. Oh, my. I think I might enter a two-book deal if I can. You know, I had a big hit with Newman, so we're talking about a couple of things, and one would be a biography. And one would be a scene book, more like Rat Pack Confidential and Ready, Steady, Go, one that I'm very enthusiastic about, mm-hmm. Set in Italy in the 50s. The biography subject, we're still kicking around a few names, and you know, they're such tender shoots, even exposing them in this dim light might kill them.
Well, my papers are open to you if you ever decide to do them. I've been speaking with Sean Levy. He's the author of Paul Newman, A Life, and several other books. It's published by Harmony Books, the division of Random House. I hope to see you again soon.
Oh, I hope so. Thanks.